Between the Lines on News Talk.
We're joined in studio by the Assistant Professor of Economics at Trinity College Dublin and also the author of the quarterly Daft.ie report, Ronan Lyons. My thanks, Ronan, for joining us in studio.
Thanks for having me in, Andrea.
Now, we'd further proof this week that rental prices are continuing to rise and we also have too few properties available for rent. Now, we've had a lot of comments from listeners on this particular issue to the station during the week and we've actually compiled some of them. And I just want to take a look at some of our listeners' thoughts on this issue. I'll start with John in Louth, who's asking the question, why don't we build more apartments and buildings with parks, etc. beside them? Like, why are we always focusing on this idea of building single family homes?
That's an excellent question, and I think it actually gets to the heart of what's wrong with the Irish housing system at the moment. At the sort of the obvious level, we can see both sale and rental prices increasing, and they've increased in particular in the urban areas for the last 5 or 6 years. But in many ways, the bubble and crash is a distraction from the big picture trends over the last 30 or 40 years. We've gone from having a falling population to having a rising population. And if you were to skip the bubble and crash and draw a line from, say, 1995 straight to 2012 and skip that whole bit in the middle, you'd actually see that for something like 50, 60, 70 years up to the 1980s, you had pretty much stable rents and prices. And thereafter, you've got rising rents and prices, and in particular in and around the cities. And that gets to what a good, healthy housing system does, which is when you have more demand, you need more supply. What kind of supply you need, and this gets to John's question, is it depends on the structure of your population. And if the weird thing is, we talk about a housing shortage, but actually we need to be specific. We don't have a shortage of houses. We have a shortage of apartments. If you look at the number of families that we have in this country, we call them families, but they're 3, 4 or 5 person households. That's what the census would describe them as. And then you look at the number of dwellings we have that can fit a family of 3 or 4 or 5 people. We actually have too many. We have a surplus of dwellings for families compared to the number of families we have in this country. What we have a shortage of is apartments. We have about 500,000 missing apartments in this country compared to two things. The first is compared to our own population structure. Mm-hmm. If you look at the number of 1 and 2 person households, we're about 500,000 short. But also when you look at other European countries, countries with a similar population structure typically have about 4 times the fraction of their dwellings in apartments than we do. We have about 12% of our dwellings in apartments. The European average is about 50%.
Right.
So we have this big gap. So I agree completely with John's question. We need to think about how we can make building apartments viable. But the one thing that does do is it gets us thinking about town centres and city centres, and perhaps his question is why? Why are we not building apartments?
Okay.
That's a political question, I think, rather than an economic one.
And even on that point as well, if we're kind of really missing the single occupancy dwellings that you mentioned for a single person or maybe two people to live in the likes of an apartment, is that a kind of a cultural societal change that perhaps we need here in Ireland? That people, maybe if they're a 1 or 2 person family, they just maybe don't want to live in an apartment?
As an economist, I think of that as what the argument you're giving there is what we would call a demand side argument. There isn't a demand for living in apartments. Actually, I think that's untrue when you look at the apartment blocks that have been built over the last 10 years. So I'm talking about more or less from the end of the bubble through to today. Any apartment blocks that have been built, there's been absolutely no shortage of households that will live in them, in particular 1 and 2 person households. And here's the real kicker. There's been no shortage of people 55 and over that will move into apartments. So we tend to think of ourselves as wanting a house and wanting to own a house. Mm. Actually, we have one of the lowest rates of home ownership in Europe, not one of the highest. And anytime we build apartments, there's plenty of people who live in them, including older people who we think may be the most reluctant to live in apartments. So really, rather than a demand side problem, I think of this as a supply side problem. What this means is politicians, and this is particularly relevant this week of all weeks with the Ireland 2040 plan, need to be thinking about allowing our cities to grow and to grow up rather than to spread out.
Okay. And can you just, because you've touched on that idea of, I suppose, the fact that we need more apartments and perhaps it is a political consideration, but is there any reason why we're not building more of them or enough of them to meet this demand?
So there's probably two main factors. The first is the political one, that if you if you're the government and you release a report and it says, you know, we're going to allow significant numbers of apartments to be built. In fact, we're going to focus our housing supply on apartments in and around Dublin and Cork and Galway. Already you could hear the rural TDs saying, well, what about RA, or what are we going to get in the plan? So we have more rural TDs than we have a percentage living rurally. So that skews the power a little bit. But perhaps the other, that's the big picture one. Mm. The actual nitty-gritty at the moment is, if you talk to developers, say the companies that build apartments in other cities and are active in Dublin, but when they build in Dublin, they build hotels or offices. When you ask them why, they say, well, if I build a block of apartments now, for a two-bed apartment, I'd have to charge a monthly rent of €2,000 just to break even. You look around the city, there's only a couple of parts in Dublin, and certainly nothing outside Dublin, where you could get a rent of €2,000 a month for a two-bed.
So it's back to the cost of, the actual cost of the development is
exactly,
what we're back to.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's something that we looked at actually in one of our earlier programmes as well here on Between the Lines. I just want to just kind of continue that theme that you're talking about in terms of getting people into different kinds of properties. What about, Paul, for instance, in Dublin made the comment to us earlier this week about the idea of encouraging more multiple occupancy dwellings. Is that something that could be done in the future?
Yeah, if you think about how I mentioned there about how much we are out of sync with the rest of Europe in terms of the structure of our housing. If you think about the housing in Ireland, we effectively have just two types of home. We've the family home and we've the nursing home. Right? They're basically your two types of home that we have in this country. And you look at other countries, they have a whole life cycle of housing. That when you move out from your parents first, you're in student accommodation or something similar. Then you go into an urban high-rise apartment.
Share, which many of us are in.
And this is the thing. We think of it as a house share, but actually in other countries, you would live in an apartment by yourself or with one other person rather than three or four other people. So we've become sort of normalised into thinking of houses, but actually apartments in other countries is what you'd live in. Co-living is one aspect of that. Now, clearly with co-living, you need to be sure that there's certain minimum standards that are being met, but actually most of the co-living that's developments that are happening around the world now are aimed at the top end of the income bracket, not the bottom end. There's no worry about the standards. They're going for the cream of the crop. It's the sort of the ideal way to live, so to speak, in your 20s at the moment. There's the first signs of co-living coming into Ireland at the moment. There's a building on Fitzwilliam Square that's getting converted to co-living use. And I think there's been a couple of planning permission feelers put out around co-living. The real challenge for, not just for Dublin City Council, but for all our local authorities and indeed for the Department of Housing, is that we have incredibly rigid minimum specifications around what you can build as accommodation. Is it future-proof? Is it designed to be flexible enough to allow co-living or multiple occupancy? Because if it's not, what you're going to end up with is effectively all the pressure to build getting squeezed out into either student accommodation, which is getting built, and then out, all the way at the other end to yet more 3 and 4 bed family homes, which the country doesn't need.
And I suppose it's a little bit more of a kind of an American perhaps option to have this idea of, it's a little bit like the student accommodation, except it's for young professionals or people who are working, whereby you sort of own basically your bedroom, which might be en suite, but you're in a kind of a co-living sitting room kitchen. And for some people, that's just not an attractive option. But in order to try and meet the level of demand that we have out there at the moment, it's probably something we'll have to consider long term.
Well, this is the thing. Often we confuse, for some people, this does not sound attractive with, we're going to start forcing people to live in them. And of course, that's not true. What you do is you try something out and see if it works. And if it works, if there's enough demand for it, it doesn't matter if some people don't want to live in it. They don't have to.
Yeah.
We're not trying to change everyone to live in this. But you're right. What that kind of multiple occupancy development allows is a level of service that you just will never get in your standard housing estate. Because you're going to have, this is swimming pools in the basement, gyms on the first floor, meeting rooms, party rooms, cinemas. Those kinds of facilities work if you're sharing them with 900 other people. If you have to pay for them yourself, of course, nobody's going to be able to afford that.
Okay. I just want Ronan to look at maybe some of the other areas, because we have probably a lot of people listening to this programme this morning who are accidental landlords. Perhaps they have one or two properties that they bought as kind of long-term investments for the future, and now they're in a position where they're in negative equity, and actually renting out that apartment isn't really a reality because they're having to often sometimes make up the shortfall in certain parts of the country. Is there an argument to be made for actually reducing the level of tax that your smaller, maybe one-off landlord has to pay in order to try and encourage more people to do that?
We're in something of a a catch 22 around how we treat, you know, tax purposes, how we treat the small time landlord, because if they're competing with two groups, unlike most businesses, they're, on the one hand, how you treat a buy to let landlord and how you treat an owner occupier, they're very relevant comparisons. Because if you, for example, if you give full mortgage interest relief to an owner-occupier, then you kind of have to do the same for a buy-to-let investor. Otherwise, it's not a level playing field. But at the same time, what we have done actually is we've gotten rid of mortgage interest relief for owner-occupiers and got rid of it in part for buy-to-lets. But at the same time, somebody who invests in buy-to-let could easily invest in something else, commercial property or need any other kind of asset. And there, any cost, including the cost of debt, can be written off against their income. So we've got ourselves stuck now where we've tried to get a level playing field with these two completely different spheres, and that's not possible. So for negative equity landlords, in a way, this may not be the message that they would want to hear, but what we need to do as a society is we need to allow, if it's a business idea from 12 years ago that failed, that business needs to be allowed to fail without taking that landlord with them. You need to be able to write off that and say, okay, this didn't work, not hand the keys back and off you go, but hand the keys back relatively small, time out, and then you can go again.
Can I just ask you, because Dan, one of our listeners, actually got in contact with us to sort of draw the comparison with the likes of France, where he made the point that, you know, small landlords there pay a flat rate tax of around 20% on half of the annual income. So they don't have things like complicated allowances, and it's, you know, it's simple, and it's kind of, I suppose, more reasonable to try and administer. Is that something that could be done here? We're 52% is the tax here, isn't it?
Yeah, and I mean, this is an important point. The simpler the tax system, the better. Because the more complicated you make it, the more allowances you have, the more holidays or very special exemptions for particular things, the more it's just a game for certain professional services and they get income out of it. But really, it's not creating a good tax system. The best tax system is a simple one. So if you can say, look, here's the flat tax rate that applies for this kind of investment, if you want to encourage particular kinds of activity like buy-to-let investment in residential property, then the tax is an obvious lever. However, I don't think it's the only answer here. I don't think we should assume that this is just a tax problem because, for example, the REITs, the Real Estate Investment Trusts, they face a very different tax system to an ordinary citizen who buys a second property as an investment. For them, the tax is not a concern. For them, the cost is a concern. So if you push too hard on the tax lever, you end up with unintended consequences. We found this out in the 90s and 2000s, where they started out with an urban renewal tax incentive, and then it worked so well, they said, sure, let's give it to loads of places, and it became a rural renewal tax incentive, and now we have empty properties strewn across the country.
We have floods and floods of messages or comments, I suppose, from people and messages here to the station throughout the week, all accidental landlords. They're not in a position to meet the repayments, and, you know, obviously only apartments in certain areas are those, the likes of Dublin, that are really in the kind of high level of huge demand, and that's maybe in many cases where people are actually making the money on rent. Is there anything that can be done to try and help them?
Well, think of this in two ways. Either, I suppose, the ultimate question for them is, do they want to stay in that business or not? And many of them will tell you no. And that's sort of what I was saying earlier about if you want to allow that particular business venture to fail, you should be allowed to let it fail. You tried a business, so you bought a property in 2005, it hasn't worked out. Why
but
should you carry
been,
that?
I suppose it might have been purchased initially as that was going to be their home, I suppose, effectively. Now they're in negative
Sorry,
equity.
The accidental landlords, yeah, as opposed to people who, I take the point. For accidental landlords, again, the comparison with owner-occupiers here is relevant. If you think of the reason an accidental landlord is so ill-treated by the tax system, suppose you've got number one and number two on a particular street, and they're the same house, the three-bed semi-D or whatever, and in one situation, you have John who owns and lives in number one and Mary who owns and lives in number two. They don't pay income tax. They don't pay any. There's no tax liability there apart from the standard property tax. Now, suppose they moved house and John now owns one but lives in number two and Mary does the opposite. Right? Nothing's changed from society's point of view. We still have two houses and they're occupied by the same two people. But now you've got a completely different tax system. And that's what I mean about a simpler tax system is the better one. If you have all these
different systems, and that's where an accidental landlord gets hit, because now they've got an income tax bill, and that makes it even more difficult for them to sort of get out and get clean.
I want to talk a little bit about the tenants, for instance, because Samantha in Dublin made the comment earlier this week that those that are trapped in the rental market are tired of hearing about the poor old landlord, you know, and Samantha made the point that the Dublin situation is broken and that we need to kind of talk about those who are pretending they're selling properties in order to try and get a higher rent. Like, can that situation be stopped? I know we have rules and regulations that are now in place for landlords that they can't do that, but there is still anecdotal evidence that happens.
Yeah, I mean, there's two answers here. The first is, I suppose it's treatment and prevention, right? So what happens when this kind of thing happens? You need good policing, effectively. You need the rules to be enforced. And for that, you need the RTB, the Residential Tenancies Bureau. That needs to be well-resourced so that they can go out and act as the enforcer of the rules for both landlords and for tenants in the rental sector. You know, the landlords will give you stories about terrible tenants and tenants will give you stories about terrible landlords. There has to be someone outside enforcing the rules. But that's only treating the bad cases. How do you prevent that situation from arising in the first place? To do that, you need to shift the balance of power, of market power, away from almost completely on the landlord side to giving the tenants some market power. And that will stop the worst excesses. But to do that, you need more supply. It's back to the same issue about more supply.
The rent pressure zones, have they worked?
Well, I think it'd be a brave policymaker who would argue that they've worked. I mean, they're supposed to cap rental inflation at 4% in and around the major cities. And that has not been the case over the last 18 months.
So is it fair to say that those that were currently in a tenancy when the rent pressure zones were introduced, are they the only real kind of beneficiary in this, not those that were currently looking for a property during their introduction?
Yeah, so if you, we, as part of the DAFT report, I think 3 quarters ago, the rental report about 9 months ago, we surveyed tenants. We picked a bunch of tenants who started their tenancy in 2013 and asked them what had happened their rent over the course of their tenancy. It was interesting that the headline finding was that rents had gone up by 60% in the market. But if you had stayed in the same place, you'd only seen an increase of about half that in your own rent. So sitting tenants were actually doing better anyway. And then they got this further protection with rent pressure zones. The rent pressure zones are supposed to apply across tenancies as well. So if you start a tenancy, you're supposed to be able to say to the landlord, look, I want what the last guy had plus 4%. But de facto, that's not going to happen. Because of the very reason they were introduced, that demand is so strong. If you're at the head of a queue of 100 people, you're not going to say, look, prove to me the rent is no more than 4% what the last guy paid. Because the landlord's going to say, look, I'll get back to you on that one. I've got 99 people to talk to.
Yeah, I've another person here I'm going to give it to. Just, Ron, maybe on a final point, like the next 2-3 years, because I don't even think we can look the 10-20 year down that sort of a road at this stage. Is there any way we can try and create more supply and reduce the level of demand, particularly in the likes of the capital urban areas?
So I suppose big picture, the best thing to do, if there's a quick win at all, the quick win has to be in managing our existing stock of property better. And that's not, which is currently the pressure valve in the rental market, is to squeeze more people into the existing rental stock. So instead of 3 students to a home, you now got 5. And instead of 2 professionals, you've got 4. I mean, that only works for so long. What I mean is, we do have high vacancy rates. These are not ghost estates. You know, the ghost estates are well managed and well understood. We know where they are and we know what the story with them is. This is empty individual properties scattered around the country, including in central Cork and central Dublin. But we do not have local authorities that know where every last dwelling is and who lives there or who doesn't. Other European cities have this. If you don't have a register of who owns what and who lives where, that's what we need first.
Okay, we'll leave it there for the moment. Assistant Professor of Economics at Trinity College Dublin and author of the latest quarterly rental report with DAFT.ie, Ronan Lyons, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me in.
To further discuss some of the issues raised by Ronan Lyons, I'm joined in studio by our panel this morning, Eilish Ryan from the Workers' Party, Tom Dunn, Head of the School of Surveying and Construction Management at DIT, and also Mike Allen from Focus Ireland. Well, you heard one of the first points raised there by Ronan during that interview just a few moments ago. We don't have too many houses. Instead, the issue is that we actually have too few apartments. Tom Dunn, what's your view on that?
Yeah, I think the future of urban development in Ireland will be in apartments, not in houses. I think if you're going to have houses, it means very low densities. Low densities mean long commutes. Long commutes mean poorer standards of living. And the only way out of that is to go up in the city centres and to provide people with living accommodation in apartments.
Okay. For maybe many people listening to these comments this morning, Tom, one of the things that might strike them is the fact that we did build a lot of apartments during the Celtic Tiger, some of which, for many reasons, weren't built to the best of standards. In some cases, there were shoddy conditions, etc. And we've heard of, you know, multiple different cases and stories as a result of that. For a lot of people, the idea of apartment living, it's not an attractive option to them.
No, that's very true. And one of the problems you get with apartment building is that when you buy it, you're buying into a community. There's a number of people who live around you who share the same building as you, and there's issues around the management of that. But look, apartment living is a normal feature of life right across Europe, and in fact, it's the way people have lived in urban areas since the 19th century. And I refuse to believe that Irish people will not do the same as their fellow Europeans right across the continent.
Okay. Eilish Ryan, just from as a Workers' Party councillor, just, I suppose, maybe before we maybe look at that as an option as a part of maybe social housing, but from maybe the private rental sector, do you think is more apartments, the availability, the greater availability of more apartments in urban areas, is that an answer to this problem?
I'm definitely in favour of higher density building. I don't think there's any question about that. I think it gives more people more access to really good quality amenities at a lower price, and that's what housing should be about. The reality is that when we leave the building of apartments to the private sector, they tend to go for the options that create profit. And so you have certain types of apartments such as student accommodation, which there's effectively a bubble in the north inner city because the yields in terms of profit is so high in those options at the moment. And then you have huge pressure to reduce the standards in apartments designed for homeowners or for renters for long-term accommodation. And I think that's really the problem, is that currently, because there's a drive to make profit off apartments, they're not, nobody wants to build high-quality apartments suitable for families to live in long term, and so the state just has to step in if we want to see that as an option.
And are you talking about in the private or in perhaps the social side of things?
I guess the way we would view it is that basically if you look at Dublin at the moment, there's about 70% of the population who effectively can't afford housing. You know, they either can't, they're paying more than 35-40% of their income in rent, which is unaffordable, and they can't get access to a mortgage. So for us, in fact, it's not about saying, well, there's the social housing over there and there's the private housing on the other side. It's about providing new models of housing where the majority of people have an option to rent from the state and paying a decent proportion of their income. So the state has decent rent collection and they have security of tenure for the rest of their lives. So that would actually make the entire public housing sector much more financially sustainable, because you'd have many more people on middle incomes, good incomes, renting from the state and paying more money. So that's the option that we would prefer.
Okay. Mike Allen from Focus Ireland, the idea of both the private and, I suppose, public rental sector looking at expanding upwards and developing more apartments. Ronan Lyons from daft.ie says, as you heard earlier, it's not a problem that we've too many houses. We actually have too few apartments, and that's the issue. What do you say to that?
Yeah, it was a bit... I very much get the point he was making, but there's 1,100 families in Dublin living in hotel rooms who think there aren't enough houses. And the fact that there are physically a lot of houses around the country with single people living in them is little comfort to them if they can't get access to them. So perhaps a bit more of a discussion about how the distribution of the existing stock is really important. And even if we have too many houses, if we can't get access to them because people own them and they have a right to stay there if they wish to, we still are going to have to build. But I absolutely think he's right about the increase in density, and there's agreement here. Yeah. There isn't actually anybody who's serious about this issue who doesn't accept that we need to build more, you know, higher IAs.
And why aren't we?
More density. Because there's a lot of people who aren't serious about the issue who are allowed to contribute to it. And also because the profit issue that Eilish was raising. But because we're not adequately addressing, once we all have a consensus that we need to build, the question is, how do we do that? How do we afford it? And how do we build the communities? I think the point you made yourself earlier on is very, very true, that the very poor quality of apartments that were built during the boom before has really set back a public attitude to housing and to apartments and its acceptability. And our failure to build proper communities where there, if you're going to ask a family in particular, but also single people, to live in apartments, you need much more public facilities, parkland and social areas than we typically have been building in Ireland. So it's not just a matter of getting the apartments built, it's also about building the communities and imagining decent communities and making sure we put the resources to make sure they happen.
I suppose just Ailish Ryan, the minister's favourite line at the moment is that councillors in Dublin City Council are refusing to build high density housing. Now, I do my absolute best to support high density housing wherever I can, but the reality is that the options that are put before us, for example, in the North Docks at the moment, which is probably one of the most extensive land banks in the inner city that we have access to, in the whole city that we have access to, there's enough space there to build about 3,000 apartments if you built it at a density that would allow for all the kinds of amenities that families need. So long-term family accommodation. But the housing that has been planned for that area is luxury penthouse style apartments. It is the average price of apartments in that area is upwards of €500,000. And so no, we won't be sold into supporting that type of apartment development. So I think often two things are conflated. The minister tends to say that the city council is opposed to high density, when actually what we're opposed to is this kind of dichotomy between luxury penthouses on the one hand and shoebox apartments on the other hand. And the reality is that if you want the middle option of high quality accommodation, things like, you know, windows on both sides of your living room, enough green space for your kids to play outside, you just have to remove the profit that developers want to make. There's no other way to make it.
You're talking about the state basically coming in on this. Tom Dunn, you obviously work as, and I suppose in terms of lecturing in DIT on surveying and construction management. So we haven't built upwards, and we don't seem to have a huge appetite in the Dublin area, in the urban area, to start building upwards and turn into other European and American-like cities. Why is that?
Well, the building economics are often difficult. In the past, what we built was apartments for sale, not for renting. And if you're setting about as a developer to build an apartment block and you intend to sell every one of the units to diverse people who are going to become owner-occupiers, you build in a particular way. If you want to build the same size building, but you're building to rent, you would design it in a very different way. And part of the argument about the standards that we're having is that the developers are coming in and saying, we can build to rent, but we can't build to rent if we have to apply the standards that you insist upon. And those standards are there because we have this notion that we are going to build the apartments for sale. And that goes to things like the number of apartments that can open off a core, for instance. So if you can sort out a way of allowing developers to provide accommodation to build to rent, as well as other developers who might want to build to sell, you can go a long way to working out the economics of this.
Okay.
There is an implication or assumption there that the quality of home that a person who's renting should be entitled to or expect is lower than somebody who is going to buy. I don't really see how that...
It's just what the market seems to prefer if you're going to buy an apartment is not to share your door.
I think it's very clear what the reason...
People who are wealthy obviously want high standards. Yeah, and the question is, how do we have regulations that ensure the quality decent standards are right to people who are relatively poor? There is a word in English for the type of housing that the private market creates for low-income people. And it's sold slum.
Okay, I'll just let you, Tom Dunn, just to respond to that.
No, there's no doubt about that. And in fact, I've often said that myself, that the private sector solution to kind of the housing problem we have at the moment is to build slums or to provide slums. And that's why the state intervenes and provides minimum standards. What I'm talking about is the nature of those standards. And the point Mike is making, you know, inevitably people who are wealthy and who are buying their own homes and can afford to pay for it will pay for an enhanced quality. But then you don't have to supply the enhanced quality to everybody. And certainly if we were to try and build the kind of apartments that have been built, say, down in Balls Bridge at the moment, for people who are effectively millionaires, and we insist upon that standard being provided to everybody in the market, you're going to find it very difficult to solve this housing problem. It's a bit like it's been described as, you know, you have to insist on everybody getting a BMW when a Ford Fusion will do.
I don't think anybody's suggesting that at all, actually.
Ryan from the Workers' Party.
That's a very false kind of comparison to draw. I suppose in terms of, you know, wealthy people wanting to buy luxury apartments, certainly, you know, if that's what people want to do, that's what they should be able to do. I don't think we should be providing any type of subsidies whatsoever for that kind of building. No. So, for example, the fact that huge amounts of private housing are about to be built on tracts of public land, such as O'Devany Gardens, such as St. Michael's Estate, areas that used to be homes to working class families, you know, we have no control over what developers will choose to build on that land. So they might choose to build luxury apartments that are only affordable to the elites. And that's a form of subsidy. So, you know, wealthy people should buy what wealthy people want to buy. But we as the people shouldn't have to subsidise
that.
Let's
take out the wealthy people for a minute, because an awful lot of what we're talking about, and I know it's from my own sort of age demographic and friends, are the people who were just actually your middle income earners, mm-hmm. who, you know, were really struggling to get the deposit together. They're absolutely not falling into any elite category whatsoever, and are just your normal 9-to-5 worker who's exactly. really struggling
absolutely.
To get that 10% deposit. And they're actually the people, forget about the elite for a second, they're actually the people
totally.
Who are now going in to buy houses that they can't afford to buy, when perhaps a kind of a 2-bed townhouse style apartment might actually
for
do.
For sure. So, I mean, the problem is that we have no way of controlling what type of accommodation the private sector choose to build. So they're building for the wealthy. So I guess, you know, you take that demographic, that's exactly the demographic that we're concerned about. And you think about, you know, the build cost of a house is 180,000 roughly in or around. The build cost of an apartment is probably a bit higher. And you take somebody on the average wage of about 35 to 40,000 euro, 3.5 times their income, which is what they can borrow, brings them up to about 150, 160,000. So there's an affordability gap there before you even start putting profit on top of the actual build cost of a unit. And so we have to close that gap for people on average incomes. We're talking maybe between 30 and 60,000 euro, that kind of an income earner. We have to close that gap. There's only two options for how you do that. Either you remove the profit that's being made in building, or you provide subsidies. Historically, we have always provided subsidies to home ownership. Always. And that's how it has been affordable. So Tom began by talking about the fact that, you know, everybody across Europe is content to live in apartments. And often that's because the apartments are provided for people who want to live there forever. And similarly, we feel that in many other parts of Europe, people are content to rent for their entire lives. And that's because they have full security of tenure. They have high levels of affordability. And in many countries, they are renting from the state. And so we think that alongside, you know, increasing density and the fact that I think yeah. Irish people are open to that, I also think they'd be open to renting if they had the security that goes along with it in other countries.
You mentioned, Tom Dunn, at the outset, the idea that perhaps we need to start looking at the other kind of European models. And I think for a lot of people, one of their big fears of actually long-term rental tenancies is the idea that A, the landlord can decide when they're actually 65 yep. years of age, sorry, I want to take this apartment back now, or B, the fact that, you know, what happens when they're now actually drawing down their pension? They're no longer working. They don't have that same income to be in a position to pay back
absolutely.
The mortgage.
This is, this is the big flaw in the private rental sector. Absolutely. There's no doubt about that. But there's kind of an element of, if you look back on our own history and look to the history of Dublin, I mean, Dublin City Council built apartments all over the city mm-hmm. in which people had very good lives. Mm. And now we would need to bring up the standards of those apartments, but certainly there is a big role for the state to provide directly accommodation for people in the city centres. I've no problem saying that at all, and it is part of the solution that we need to get to. I've been criticising Rebuilding Ireland because I believe what it does is it relies on the private sector to too great an extent to solve this problem, and the private sector
the state need to the state need to step in.
There's just no question in my mind okay. about that. The state needs to step in and build the kind of accommodation that people who can't afford to get into a market because their incomes are not sufficient to allow them to compete in that market, the state needs to directly provide that accommodation to those people.
Okay, Mike Allen, can I bring you in that? Mm. Do we need to go back to the government policies of old where the state actually are going to start taking responsibility for the level of supply?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that, again, that's very clear. In fact, in a strange, paradoxical way, the government accepts the principle of that argument and has for a number of years, but not acted on it. And so where it is talking about the profits that the sector make, I don't want to speak for you, but we're not there talking about the normal profits that a builder asked to do a job would. What we have in the model that we have is different layers, whether they be banks or developers or essentially taking speculative profits. So they're very, very substantial. So there are models of delivering housing where the state would go to a private builder, certainly not against direct labour, but to go to a private builder and agree to build a particular unit and we'll get it at a much, much lower price.
We aren't doing that.
Tom Dunn. The history of housing in Dublin, and you see there were famous firms like G.T. Crampton and Company. They were contracting firms building firms, and they built a lot of the housing that's now in the suburbs, the inner suburbs. But they built it on foot of a contract they got from the state, from the city council. And they were quite happy to build houses and take a profit, a builder's profit out of it. The model we have at the present time, particularly, you know, and I think it's been accentuated by Rebuilding Ireland, is one where you rely on the private sector to supply a sort of housing that the people who you're supplying to can't afford to buy in the private sector. There's no doubt about that.
Okay, just Eilish Ryan.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a contradiction often in terms of what the government is pursuing. So on the one hand, we're being told that we have to allow people the opportunity to own their own homes. And then on the other hand, we're being told that the reason for building a lot of build-to-rent accommodation through the private sector on public land is because young people have changed their attitudes and are now willing to rent for the rest of their lives. So I think, you know, the government needs to face up to which of those two things it believes to be true. And if people are willing to rent, then why shouldn't they rent publicly?
Okay, no, just Tom Dunn.
What the market is doing, what people who want to build to rent are doing, is recognising that for a period of people's lives, they wish to rent. They don't wish to buy for their own reasons. And often it's people coming into the country for a short number of years, or it's people who want to invest in their own businesses. But they're at a period in their life where they can afford to pay a decent rent. They don't want to lumber themselves with the mortgage, and they want to rent. So the
I think the point is, at the moment, there are a significant number of people who do want to buy, and they just can't because it's not there or it's not affordable. And so what you're describing there, in a sense, would be the situation we're in, a much more functioning housing market. In the moment, we've got an awful lot of people stuck in places where they really, really don't want to be and are going to have to pay very large sums, either in rent or mortgages, to get out of it. So I agree with your general point.
It's a function of supply. I mean, what the state has to do is... the big problem here, of course, is that our what we call our land management problem, land management policies are not good, i.e. how do you get a piece of agricultural land to be a piece of urban development land. The systems we have in our state for doing that are very, very wrong.
I want to ask you about the idea of the rent pressure zones, particularly in the kind of high density urban areas. Eilish Ryan from the Workers' Party, what's your view? Have they worked?
Absolutely not. There's just simply too many loopholes. So I think there's two different points. The first one is that, you know, in themselves, they're not effective because rents were already too high. Rents were already well in excess of what's affordable. And they build in a guaranteed 4% increase every year, which is ahead of inflation. So rent versus wages is increasing every year in and of themselves. But they're not working as they're supposed to, because there are still numerous loopholes to allow landlords to sell properties, to evict tenants. And unfortunately, the onus is then on the tenant to prove whether or not that was done kind of mischievously. So, for example, I'm working with somebody at the moment who whose landlord evicted them because they were selling the property. They went through all of the correct procedures to show that they were selling it.
Because they do have certain criteria to meet in order to prove they're selling it.
You can evict. Yeah, you have to supply, I think it's a legal affidavit saying that you intend to put it on the market. But once 6 months have passed, you can re-advertise that property. Now, under the new legislation, you're not allowed to re-advertise it for more than 4% of what you charged previously, but you know, there's no system for basically there's no public register of rents where the new tenant can go. Okay. Now they do have the right to ask the landlord, and it's really important people know this, they do have the right to ask the landlord for a document that shows what the previous rent was and what the new rent is, to prove that it's only 4% more. But this, there's nobody available to enforce this.
Okay.
It's effectively a kind of a gentleman's agreement.
Okay, Mike Allen from Focus Ireland, that idea that Eilish mentioned there of a rental registry or a rental registrar, is that something that needs to be implemented?
Well, I think she's absolutely right that there needs to be. If you're going to have these sort of regulations, they exist really to deal with the crisis we're in. They're not the sort of thing you would have in a properly functioning market. They're to stop the fact that the single largest cause of family homelessness is landlords evicting tenants, saying they're going to sell and increasingly to renovate. The problem is about the enforcement is, and Ronan referred to this in an interview earlier, is that if you're a big long queue of people, there's 50 people come to try and rent a particular apartment or a particular house, and somebody says, and could I have a certificate saying what the last guy was paying? You know, you're not going to get it. What's actually happening is the people are offering it at X amount of money, and people are, in a classic free market, they're bidding up the price there and then, the actual rent that they'll pay. People are offering more than the asking rent. People are offering, I'll give you 3 months deposit, I'll give you 6 months in advance. So there's an incredible building up. of this. So that anybody who is evicted from their home because the landlord is selling up or whatever is finding it virtually impossible to get back into the rented market. Okay. So there are about over 80 families became homeless in Dublin in January alone, and they are going to find it extremely hard to get back in. We've argued that for landlords who specifically bought to rent, they got a mortgage which was called a buy-to-rent mortgage, that loophole should be closed, and they should not be able to evict people on the point of sale. It wouldn't catch the genuine accidental landlord who inherited a place or had to move elsewhere. And we believe that that is a balanced response to the scale of the problem we have. And if we don't do that, anything else we talk about dealing with family homelessness is really not going to have any impact.
Yeah, I just want to ask you, Tom Dunn, about that idea of perhaps some kind of tax measures or introducing some kind of a tax break for the likes of, as Tom mentioned, the initial buy-to-let or buy-to-rent mortgage holder. But then separately, we also have the whole bundle of people that fall into the category of the accidental landlords.
You do. Now, the problem here is there is a need for a properly structured private rented sector with proper rent certainty measures in it. That is very different to the proposition that you're going to bring in rent control measures in a market where there is a crisis. The history of rent control measures been brought in a market where there is a crisis, and often they are brought in because political pressure is brought to bear and the response of the politicians is to react to that. The history of that is that it makes the situation a good deal worse. What it does is it protects the people who are in accommodation, which is what Mike is trying to do. But it does that at the expense of people who are trying to access accommodation. What tends to happen if you bring in rent control measures is that the rents go up, landlords pull out. The kind of measures that were suggested there that we're going to try and restrict the ability of landlords to get their accommodation back and sell it into a market.
To sell it vacant possession. If they can sell it.
If you sell it with a tenant, encumbered by a tenant. You've got two houses, picture two exact houses, exactly the same. One is encumbered by a tenant and the other is available with vacant possession.
So somebody's encumbered is a very...
Here
we're talking about people's homes.
I'm using the phrase that...
I think that's the problem. It's the difference between the private market and the fact that you have somebody's home.
About encumbered, there is a tenant in occupation paying a rent. So the two are going to be sold. And if that tenant in occupation has a right to remain in occupation for so long, and the landlord has no discretion over that, you remove that house from the owner-occupied market, and it's the owner-occupied market that drives the rents, that drives the prices of houses. So effectively what will happen is that there will be a two-tier market. You'll have a market where the price will be lower if you've got a property for sale with a tenant in it, and a price that's higher for the exact same house. And what will tend to happen is people will want to get the tenant out to sell the house at the higher price. That's what will happen. So effectively, the other thing that will happen is that means that investing in property is less attractive. Because one of the reasons why people invest in property is to capture the capital gains that come from the owner-occupied market.
Okay, just let me bring you in, Ailish Ryan, on that.
Yeah, I think, like, really, you know, there's all of these ideas around why rent controls don't work. They come back to the idea that somehow they limit supply, whether that's because people won't invest or because they're likely to sell up. But that talks about it as if somehow rented property is a specific type of supply, and it's not. Like, we think about what the consequences would be. First of all, I think, you know, critically, you would introduce a type of legislation Mike is talking about first before introducing rent controls. So tenants have security of tenure if their landlord does decide sell on. And then you think about, okay, well, perhaps a large number of landlords, say their tenants move on and they decide this is no longer a profitable industry, I'm stepping out of this. Either what would happen, if that happens en masse, which is generally the kind of fear that people are encouraged to believe, either the price that home would become available perhaps for somebody who wanted to own their home and reduce the price of housing for people to buy. Or in fact, what we believe should happen is that particularly those accidental landlords who don't want to be landlords, don't want to be making money out of it, they should be given a way out, you know. And the best way to do that, in our view, would be for the state to take up ownership of that property and become the landlord to that tenant, which really, you know, would provide a massive swell in housing stock. So a great example of that might be the €1.5 billion worth of buy-to-let mortgages that PTSB, Permanent TSB, are currently selling onto the market. That's an I can't even begin to think about how many tenants are at risk because of that sale, and what will happen to them when their new owner decides to sell on again, which is when the real risk comes. So Permanent TSB have indicated they won't be evicting people with the sale, but the new owner may. And you know, in that kind of an instance, it would be a great opportunity for the state to step in and become the landlord to that large group of people.
Tom, just on a final point.
Yeah. If the state doesn't step in, then you've got a big problem, and the state is not prepared to step in. And this is the fundamental problem. If you read Rebuilding Ireland, it basically says that it is relying on the private sector to supply the accommodation needed for social housing, and that will not work.
Tom Dunn, just very finally before we finish, I just want to ask about both yourself and Mike, the idea of the rates on vacant properties, vacant land, just as a way to try and, I suppose, address this rental issue over the next decade. Is there something further can be done there?
Well, certainly there's a need for a vacant site levy. That is there, and that we need to operationalise that, because what we need to do is disincentivise people to speculate in the purchase and trading of sites. And that's one of the problems you can have in a market such as the market we have at the present time. There's quite an incentive on entrepreneurial people to buy sites and hold on to them because they know the prices are going to go up. And if you have a vacant site levy, it provides a disincentive for that.
Okay, Mike Allen, just on that very point.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. I mean, and I think by understanding that there are huge incentives for people to take these speculative steps, it should push you in the direction of recognising that you need to deal with that by, as it were, penalising them for doing that rather than to create yet another set of incentives. And one of the responses the government has had to trying to use the private market for this is constantly to add one incentive on another or one incentive on another rather than actually taking control itself and saying this is what we need to achieve. Taxpayer is paying for it anyway,
okay.
So give the taxpayer the control of the solution.
Okay, lots to think about there this morning. And my thanks to our panel today, Eilish Ryan from the Workers' Party, Tom Dunn, the head of the School of Surveying and Construction Management at DIT, and also Mike Allen from Focus Ireland, and previously as well to Ronan Lyons from daft.ie. My thanks to our production team, Stephen Jordan, Aidan McKelvey and Marianne Kennedy on sound. And I'll be back next Sunday morning from 8. But for me, Andrea Gilligan, have a great day.
Between the Lines on News Talk.